Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's Sunday. If it's Sunday, you know you're listening to The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, and are engineered by the great Evan DeVito. Evan, have you fallen asleep already? Has my intro been that boring? No, we're very excited. Weather has started to turn. Things are looking on the up and up. It's been a tough winter, but we're getting our first hints of spring and the summer coming. And in the spirit of growing things, we have a great show. We have as our guest the head of the entire Grow NYC organization, Marcel Van Ooyen.
Pretty close, yeah.
How would you say it?
Van Ooyen.
Van Ooyen. All right. Oy vey. Yeah. I can't believe I screwed that one up. This interview is going terrible, Evan. No, we can edit that out. But Grow NYC is, we're going to talk all about that. And we're also afterwards going to have Larry Bokel come on and talk about the summer as it relates to the international trucking scene, which is always funny. We love having Larry on because I always ask our listeners, look around you and name one thing that has not been on a truck at some point or other. And when you look at it that way, you know, the truckers of America play a huge role in our economy, and it's always fascinating to get an update. We're going to ask Larry about, you know, 100-degree weather and the summer, you know, what effect that has on the national trucking scene. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, we are very honored to have Marcel on. So you used to be the legislative director for the New York City Council, and then you went up to head all of Grow NYC. So it would be better to come from you. Describe the many tentacled organization that Grow NYC is.
Well, Grow NYC has been around for over 40 years in New York City. We have four main programs. We run the Green Market Farmers Markets, the largest farmers market program in the country.
Are there 50 of those?
Over 50 now. We're up to, hopefully this year, it'll be about 54 green markets, 12 youth markets, and a wholesale farmers market up in the Bronx.
Youth markets being?
They're team-run farm stands. They're markets that sell the same vegetables at Green Market, but they're run by teens from a community. Mm-hmm. Work with a community partner, train them to run a farm stand, teach them how to run a small business. We source the produce from local green market farmers, and then they resell it in a community that generally couldn't support a traditional green market. We build school and community gardens around New York City. We do environmental and food education, and we run the Office of Recycling Outreach and Education, which basically teaches people how to recycle better, reduce waste, and compost, and collect textiles, etc.
Are you behind that many-colored poster that I have in my lobby that says, you know, blue goes with me, and they have a little face of the garbage cans?
Oh, no, those date back to, I think, the Giuliani times. The new ad campaign that put out by the city is called Recycle Anything, because we've expanded beyond what you could originally put in the blue and green bins to pretty much all recyclable materials.
Well, very, very interesting. Did you ever see that Portlandia episode where they have like 70 different containers, each a different shade of?
I'm a big fan. I haven't seen that one.
That's very funny.
I did see the We Can Pickle That.
Yeah, We Can Pickle That.
Which hit home basically because of Green Market.
Yeah, well, Green Markets now, there are over 50 of those. I mean, most people know the Union Square, but these are populating all five boroughs and maybe just to contextualize the questions I'll ask you, give some of our listeners who don't know a little history of the Green Market and its role in the city.
Sure. Green Market is over 30 years old. It's, as I said, the largest farmers market program in the country. We have over 200 producers that basically come from around 200 miles from New York City. They are basically pick, catch, grow their own product. And then they're sold at one of our markets. We organize the markets, promote them, and we have markets in all five boroughs, in pretty much every community. So we boast, in Union Square alone, over 300,000 visitors on a September day, but all told, we probably see upwards of 10 million visitors to our markets around New York City.
Unbelievable. And something that people don't know, I mean, it keeps about probably more than this 35,000 acres in production.
Yeah, those are basically the acres that our farmers are farming in order to produce the product that is sold at our markets. They manage more than that, but that's pretty much what we do in the Hudson Valley and beyond to keep farmland preserved and small farmers active.
Mm-hmm. For sure. As we'd like to say, as I say when I do my staff trainings and on the radio station here, when they pave over a farm, that's never going to become a farm again.
So no,
it's important.
Yeah, it's very important. Farming has been disappearing in the Northeast at a dramatic rate. The ability to sell directly to consumers puts money in the farmers' pockets, keeps them farming on their land, and we've now seen, since we've been around so long, third-generation, fourth-generation farmers who started out selling in the market and then have handed the farm off to their kids and now continue to farm, and then again to their grandkids who will continue to farm and keep that farm active and selling great product to New Yorkers.
So now you are going past just direct to consumer and you have launched a wholesale market. That must be very complicated. Tell us about how that's going.
Very, very complicated. You mentioned trucking. I don't recommend anyone get in the trucking business. We figured that about, 98% of what people eat, and might be even higher in New York City, comes through wholesale channels, whether you're buying at a restaurant like this, Roberto's, or from a grocery store or wherever. That needs to be brought down from a farm, packed and then unpacked and then distributed through various channels here, whether it's a wholesale market up in the South Bronx or other places. So we figured that if we wanted to keep those mid-sized farmers, who are the ones that were disappearing at the quickest rate, active and farming, we had to figure out how to crack the nut when it came to wholesale distribution, and that's what Green Market Co. is all about.
Who's doing the sales?
We have one intrepid person on our staff,
that's
Brian.
That's awesome. I'd like to have him on. That's what I do. I sell stuff all the time.
We'll get Brian out here, and he can teach you about the ins and outs of selling vegetables in New York City, which is a very competitive environment to sell in.
Very interesting. And the farmers obviously probably make a little bit less when it goes wholesale, but they're probably happy to see their product move in the first place.
Yeah, we try to pay them a fair amount of money for a fair price for their product, which they don't get through other wholesale channels.
Do you pay up front or do you only pay if it's sold?
We don't sell on consignment. We broker the deal. Once it's purchased, we collect the money from the person buying it and then write the check to the farmer in a timely manner, which often doesn't happen in the wholesale.
Well, I'd like to. My next person I'd like to have on is your accounts receivable person, because that's no.
Well, you're looking at them. I sign the checks as well. I don't actually process them, but I actually sign them.
Oh man! So now, how does one lead? And you're the leader of this very multi-tentacled organization amidst such, established grandfathered-in constituents. I mean, you have farmers that were bringing baseball bats to man the first farmers market under the Queensboro Bridge in the late 70s, and now here you are trying to bring change while still being true to the foundation. So,
well, I think you have to, as you mentioned, stay to your core values, and our core values are supporting farmers, providing fresh, healthy produce to all New Yorkers, and creating the next generation of educated eaters. So that's kind of what we do. We try to innovate by creating new programs like Green Market Co., the Grow to Learn, which is our school garden initiative, which we created and now boasts over 400 registered school gardens in New York City. We're developing our own line of value-added products that
are
made from local products.
You can pickle that?
Yeah, we can pickle that, yeah. I'm thinking more hot sauce and salsa than pickled, because some of our We have folks doing that already. But I was meeting with Brooklyn Brewery this morning about our Green Market Wheat beer, which is a beer made with 70% local product, which was one of the first of its kind in New York State. And they're very excited about the product, and we hope to expand the line and go into kegs. So hopefully we can share one of those here one day.
Very interesting. That would be great. Garrett Oliver is a great brewmaster over there. I just saw him. He recorded something in that very seat for the BBC, and they were like, we need a tech-savvy location that we can call in and use that for the BBC. And I was like, I am so excited that the BBC is using one of our Heritage's humble facilities.
Well, should I start speaking in a British accent?
Yes, or French. We have some French journalists here from La Libération. La Libération! So now, how will growth happen?
Well,
is it just more markets, or is it more programs, or?
I think it's both. You know, we try to remain cutting edge when it comes to developing new programs. Try to see what the horizon provides when it comes to providing opportunity for farmers, and really trying to find ways to get that great produce that our farmers grow into communities that are underserved. Mm-hmm. We were the first organization, I think, nationally to work with the Department of Health here in New York City to create the incentive program, the Health Buck program. And that program does really amazing work. What it is if you go to a green market when health bucks are available and you spend $5 with your food stamp EBT card, you get a $2 coupon, which increases your buying power 40%, allows the federal money that's flowing in the city to go into the pockets of small family farmers instead of large commodity farmers, and also really provides access to the best, healthiest produce you can possibly find for all New Yorkers.
I never understood why anyone ever made the argument for poor people to eat bad food, cheap food, unhealthy food, antibiotic-ridden food. I mean, in my world, it's meats with Heritage Food. So I was like, why would you tell a poor person to eat some antibiotic-ridden, top-heavy chicken that suffered in a factory farm? Better to eat less meat, but eat the best. And certainly this value-added program and coupon program brings the best food.
Yeah, it evens out the buying power between, you know, bad food and good food. Mm-hmm. And sadly, our nation, you know, has a history of incentivizing large commodity farmers to produce corn and soybeans, which gets turned into high fructose corn syrup and then turned into the food that is sold in low-income communities at a cheap price.
So. And those farmers get rich. Meanwhile, the small farmers that sell expensive food or to the rich, good quality food to the rich, often remain poor. It's a struggle. So it's like all crazy how that
works.
Well,
I wouldn't say it's expensive food. I would say that it's food that actually has a real price behind it, incentivized price that is basically subsidized by the federal government.
So how many food stamp dollars come through your program each year?
With the Health Bucks combined, we have over $1 million in sales and food stamps and Health Bucks. It started out in 6 years ago with $1,000. So we've been growing steadily at an astronomical percentage. And now we're very excited. We're over $1 million and we hope to keep growing.
Hmm. So how come no prepared food? I mean, we have these French guys here from Le Figaro. And, you know, I lived in Italy for, la Libération, zut. Zut alors, I finally get to use zut alors. La Libération, pardon. You know, there, and also I've been to Ferry Plaza. Prepared food and being able to eat there is a big part of the experience of going to a farmer's market. And I understood what I always guessed is you wanted to be good to the local businesses. For instance, let's say City Bakery on Union Square. You know, hey, they're using Green Market stuff. Why would we be competing with them? But now that there's so many McDonald's and Starbucks and big chain stores, would you ever revisit that and allow, for instance, the chicken farmer to sell chicken sandwiches? And would that attract more people?
Well, our agreement with the Parks Department prevents us from selling a lot of that. I think the theory that you mentioned behind that is we want to support the local businesses. If you look at the history of Union Square as an area, had one of the lowest vacancy rates of any parts of the city when the economy was bad a few years ago. You know, there's a Whole Foods now, a Trader Joe's, Union Square Cafe, and you know, Gramercy Tavern, and Gotham Bar and Grill, all these wonderful restaurants all moved into the area because of the market. And they prepare the food. They take what's coming from the farmers and turn it into something wonderful. You will see a lot more value-added products being produced by our farmers now.
Your label.
Not under our label, under their label. They're making salsa and sauces and kimchi and hummus and a whole variety of products now that you didn't see before. Mm-hmm. So the farmers are getting innovative in creating their own products, and we support that. But we don't want to, we don't want to cannibalize the restaurants that are, buying from the farmers and creating, good product and are paying the money for the bricks and mortar near there. So there's a fine balance between, creating a public market, which is, one that you'll see prepared food, and a farmer's market, and staying true to our mission.
Interesting. Is there a tension between the old school and the new school? Is there even a new school, a new breed of farmers that are coming in? I mean, I remember the story of Nina Plank coming in and saying, I want to change this and this and that. I mean, it's not so easy to just come in and make improvements. Is there a tension?
Well, there was a lot of tension, I think, in Green Market in years past. I think we've been able to lift that by involving the farmers in our thought process, and we have a FCAC, which is a Farmer Consumer Advocate Committee that works with us and works on our rules. And I think we've been, the main thing that farmers want is they want to be treated fairly. They want a good place to sell their product, and they want customers. So by providing those main, those things that they need and really creating a vibrant market, we've been able to work with them to, get over a lot of the problems of the past. So I don't think there's tension between new and old farmers. I think the old farmers are a great resource for the new farmers. Mm-hmm. They often, graduate out of their farm and take over their farm or take over a farm similar to them. So everyone, even though we have 200 odd individual business people, basically selling in the same space, we've been able to create a really vibrant and market which everyone's supporting each other. So we're very proud of that.
So, I mean, my last question I got to ask, how the hell did you get such a job and where do you go from here? Because, it's totally unique in the country to have such an historic and new thing all at once. And then, you worked in government before. So is there a next logical step?
Well, I kind of think I have one of the greatest jobs in New York City. And my wife reminds me of that, who works in advertising. So, but I think part of that is I have the best staff you can possibly find.
How many people work under you?
We have about 140 odd employees full time now.
And you're responsible for all of them.
I am. I keep them employed and keep them working. So
how much of your time is spent behind the scenes looking at finances and fundraising, and how much is it actually programming and expanding?
They don't let me out of the office much, sadly. I spend a lot of time fundraising, writing checks, doing all the both development and other work that you see behind the scenes. And I have a terrific staff, including Michael Horowitz, who runs Green Market, and David Hurd, who runs our recycling office, and a lot of great directors, Gerard, who does greening, and Mike Zam. And they all do a really great job representing the organization. So my job, is a little behind the scenes, which is terrific. But I get to think of the crazy ideas and force them on them and make them do new things.
Now, how much money, how big an organization is Grow NYC? How many millions of dollars is it? And then how much of that is already committed? And how much do you have to actually be responsible to raise on an annual basis?
Our budget this year will be around $11 million. I would say about a third of that comes from fee-related things. The rest we have to raise through private donations, individual donations. So anyone listening, growNYC.org, go on and
GrowNYC.org. What's an appropriate gift? I know it's what's significant, but do you have like the base family gift? Is it $100 or?
Anything over $50 is greatly appreciated. We can use that and put it to good use, teaching kids and really working on some of the programs that people don't see, the Green Market, et cetera. We have great programs up in the Bronx that are working with inner city kids to have them work in a garden, have them run their own youth market farm stand, learn how to grow food, and teaching their fellow community members how to eat better and think about food.
Well, very, very interesting. That's growNYC.org, and we hope to have you on many, many times. If they don't let you out of the office, we can call. But thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we're obviously huge fans and customers. So.
Well, wonderful to be here. It's a wonderful show, and I'm happy that you invited me.
Oh, yeah. Well, come again. So stay tuned, and we're going to bring on Larry Bokel from Cannonball Express.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
All right, we're back to the main course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We had a great interview with Marcel Van Ooyen, the executive director of Grow NYC. And now we have Larry Bokel, probably the person that's been on my show the most over the years. Welcome, Larry.
Hey, thank you, Patrick. I always enjoy being on.
Yeah, well, Larry is the, what is your title there? In fact, I don't even know.
Well, my general title is general manager of Cannonball Transportation Company. I have wear a lot of hats, generally supervisory hats and safety hats is my main priority. Managing the fleet, about 85 trucks and drivers and office staff.
Now, what is, you say safety, what are some of the biggest safety issues that Cannonball experiences?
Well, all carriers are rated by what they call a Federal Motor Carrier Safety Association SafeStat scores, which are published on the internet for anybody to see. And in order to keep your business prosperous and growing, a lot of shippers look at those safety ratings, and that's how they judge who they use as a carrier. The safest carriers are the ones you're looking for. So it's my responsibility to make sure that all of the rules are met, and when we have roadside inspections with the Department of Transportation, that we don't receive any violations or citations, that our accidents are down. And our logbook issues, there's no illegal activity going on within the logs or maintaining their hours of service. So generally speaking, it's maintaining the operation so it meets the laws of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Association.
So at what point during the course of a week, month, or year do you interact with the drivers? Is it a weekly interaction with each one of them? Do you meet them as they're loading or as they're leaving or as they're on the roads?
Well, we're still a big company but small enough where I pretty much see every driver every week. I have an office that's right in the middle of the operation where they're easily accessible to me, where they can come and go as they arrive back to Omaha, Nebraska, or before they leave. And plus, I do probably, I can't tell you how many phone calls a day that I get from my drivers, but it probably ranges between 40 and 50 calls per day from drivers. And then I send text messages to some drivers, and then they all seem to pass through the building, usually on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday, where I get to meet them all on a weekly basis.
And what are they calling you about?
Well, they usually call and tell me that there was possibly they needed some borrow some money, that they had an unexpected tire repair, or they call me and tell me they're running early and they'd like to know if there's any additional business that they can pick up on their way back because they're ahead of schedule. Or they'll just call me and tell me that they have a family reunion end of May and they like to take a week off at that time of the year. It's just a lot of times it's small business related matters, but a lot of personal conversation, because I'm not going to tell you they're lonely on the road, but they do enjoy conversation with people that want to listen and discuss their lives even off outside of the business.
How many of your, what percentage of your 85 drivers have a CB radio?
You know, it's kind of like a dying breed anymore. I would guess about 20% of my drivers do, and I would think of that 20%, very few of them actually use it. Anymore with satellite radio, they're able to turn on NASCAR or listen to Comedy Central or listen to smooth jazz, and they're not really interested in watching for Smokey the Bears anymore because it's so important to maintain a legal speed limit. You're not out trying to you know, get down the highway at a faster than legal speed, and you're not out there, you know, trying to communicate with the drivers going in the opposite directions because you got nobody to talk to. You're pretty much settled in your condo truck, which is actually the home to many of them, and they're comfortable and they listen to their satellite radios and they go on down the road, and it's become a comfort zone where the CB is more of an irritation nowadays than an information vehicle.
Very, very interesting. So, you know, I'll get to the main question. I find all this stuff so fascinating, and, you know, people who've listened to my show before know I always say every time you're on, and sometimes even when you're not, you know, look around your house or your office and name something that has not been on a truck. And, you know, most of the time that stuff is coming from these national trucks like Cannonball Express. So my question to you for this installment is, summer is here. Things are about to go from cold to 80, 90, upwards of 100 degrees. Gas prices go up. You know, it's just a new season. The winter's over. Summer's about to begin. Does that mean anything different for the trucking community?
It does. It means quite a bit. We usually take extra precautions in the summer because we're dealing with tourism on the highways of the road. You got people traveling in their cars as families while school is out. And there's more road and congestion, and there's construction in the summertime in states like Nebraska where you can only do it, you know, basically from April through November. So your construction increases and traffic slows down because there's more of it, and things like that really change the way we do things. Now, you ask about, I'm a refrigerated carrier. In the summertime, some of my business mix changes. I start hauling, for instance, chocolates and candies. They can ship those on dry vans most of the year. But in the June, July, August season, they can't put them in an 80-degree dry van, so they start shipping them on refrigerated carriers such as us. So we have some business that is only 3 months out of the year, and that's pretty much the candy type of business. Also, when school's out, tourism picks up, as I mentioned, and then the areas like Orlando, Florida, or Anaheim, California, they start ordering more freight because they've got more people coming through their amusement parks or whatever. So you see a lot more what we call food service transportation, food that goes to a business that sells it to the customer as a serving. In the off months when schools are in, we do a lot of school lunch program hauling, and specifically a lot of eggs, both dry powdered eggs and the patty eggs like you'd see on the Egg McMuffin, and eggs in general. So school lunch program drives a lot of our business, plus off-season vacationers drives the other 3 months, and then seasonality, of course, with the warm weather on my candy producers.
Very interesting. Now, let me ask you this. Very interesting. I'll just give you an example of my work, and you can tell me if it applies to other types of things. So there's this disease that's killing all these pigs around the country, and the price of pigs is going way high. A couple of years ago, commodity corn prices were way high. So, you know, my foods cost a lot more to produce. Do the ups and downs of Wall Street and the marketplace affect business? And if so, how?
I'll tell you how it affects my business. If the price of beef or the price of pork or the price of turkey fluctuates, some end users may be able to switch away and say, let's say a hot dog manufacturer, they can make hot dogs out of turkey, beef, any meat block by just changing their ingredients domination. So they can keep their prices low by just using the cheapest meat block. But if you're serving steak at your restaurant, you're going to not be able to shy away and change to turkey or pork, obviously. But what you may do is try to purchase your beef from a location closer to your destination. Many of my people in the Omaha area, we're the beef state, we ship and haul beef to all 48 states. If you're in New York and you come to the point where you can't afford to pay anymore because the markets are so high, you might try to find a supplier in Pennsylvania or Ohio where you can buy it and the freight costs will be less because it's not transported 1,400 miles. It's only going 200 or 300 miles. That's kind of what I see changing. But when when volume goes up, it's usually because the raw materials market goes down and people can freeze the product. Then they do what they call spot buying. They might buy all of their ribs in January for the summer months to sell. Some manufacturers refuse to freeze their meats, so they're at a disadvantage from price protection by pre-buying raw materials, so they have to go with the market. So it becomes an issue where you're either going to charge more on your menu or you're going to try to add more salads or pork or other meat blocks, which are cheaper at that time. But it does become an end-user issue when the markets are up. And pretty much, as you mentioned, pork. I mean, pork's one of the last ones to go up. All the meat blocks have been very expensive over the last couple of years, and it just continues to go higher.
Very, very interesting. So, and gas prices have been consistent?
Diesel prices have been about flat for the last year and a half. They don't seem to edge above the... They average about $4 a gallon for the last many, many months. They don't seem to fluctuate much right now.
Oh, very interesting. Well, Larry, it's always great to have you on. I really think you should do your own show. When you retire to Arizona or somewhere nice, you can definitely do a show. But it's fascinating. So thank you so much for giving us
some of
your day, and we'll have you back in 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully.
Anytime, Patrick. You have a great Easter's.
All right. You too, Larry. Say hi to the team.
Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to The Main Course. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Marcel Van Ooyen, the Executive Director of Grow NYC, and Larry Bokel, the General Manager at Cannonball Express. We will be back at the HRN with Arts and Seizure.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.